Well, thank you for sticking around to hear my talk. I'm going last so I can go as long as I want to, right? No. My name is Casey Schmidt. I'm a faculty at the Desert Research Institute, and I'd like to introduce some of my colleagues. David Howlett is an urban and community forester with the Nevada Division of Forestry, and this project is a good amalgamation of our interest in soil science and his interest in urban forestry specifically. Also, Vimma Lanier and some colleagues at the University of Florida worked on some of the phosphorus-related work to this project. All right, so this is the story that many of us know out west. There's a forest type called pinyon juniper that's encroaching into areas where it never would have been historically, or at least at those densities, and that's because we've prevented fire for a long time. And so now we have these really dense stands of PJ in areas where they weren't historically, and that's displacing native wildlife and native plant communities. So a lot of government agencies are really working to reduce that, to minimize our impact of fire suppression for a long time. Usually, there's really no value to this wood, so the status quo is usually to just put it into piles or burn it or to chip it or to leave it on site, and we wanted to look at an alternate scenario where we turn some of those pile burns into biochar and hopefully get some benefits out of it. So we're kind of at the early stages of analyzing this unique biochar production process, and this biochar process started when a Nevada Division of Forestry employee named Eric Rousseau got the funds to procure this very simple kiln. And we think that this kiln is an appropriate technology for integrating with the activities of wildland foresters, and I'll explain more on that later. And the idea is to potentially develop a market for this PJ that wasn't there. And we're focusing on two areas, plant nurseries and urban and community forestry. And a lot of that is because of David's interest in urban forestry, but we think there's a big potential in this application because you can apply a lot of biochar to a nursery container or to a street tree well or urban and suburban gardens. And there's been some evidence that you need to apply a lot of PJ biochar to get any sort of benefit. And at that level of application, you couldn't spread it on a big alfalfa or hay field, for instance. So this is the system. It's a very simple kiln. It's run by foresters, and sometimes inmates do this kiln. Two people can produce biochar in this kiln. It's about $2,000 each, so it's a pretty cheap system, similar to the system that was described in Africa. That's pretty large scale. You can't really tell from that picture, but it produces a fair amount of biochar, and you can tell that you get the scale perspective from this. Those are large firefighters, not inmates this time. And you pack the wood in there like you would, like a Boy Scout builds a campfire. You can use whole logs. You don't have to chip it on the front end, so there's no processing on the front end. You do have to process on the back end, and I'll get more to that later. So you light the fire at the bottom where you're allowing oxygen to be exposed to the system, let it burn for an hour, and then you seal it off with soil. So that's another elegant thing, I think, about this system is that you can take it out into remote sites and just use the soil that's around you. You let that cook for 24 hours, so maybe this is a slow pyrolysis, and then you put out the fire. And the system can be left alone, you don't have to watch it. And you produce a biochar that looks like this, but if you look at it through your own eyes, it looks like this. And you can see the wood going in, and you see the biochar looks almost the same, but it's very friable, of course. And so one of the questions we have is, well, now we've got these large chunks of biochar, we can't apply it in the soil like this, or maybe we can. How do we process that? Do we need to grind it into a fine powder that we're going to breathe and give us endocrine disruptors? Or can we use coarser material? And this is very relevant for nursery applications, as I'll explain. So we have questions with how to process. You can read the specs on these kilns. We've recently procured the funds to get 10 of these kilns. So there's 10 of these in production. So multiply all these values by 10. So I mentioned we're going to focus in two areas. One is urban forestry. And I don't need to tell this audience too much, but there's a lot of benefits to street trees beyond just they're pretty. And people have quantified this in Las Vegas with Nevada Division of Forestry folks, looking at air pollution mitigation values. But street trees have a really rough go of it. These are lifespans of different street trees. They're compacted, they're not irrigated, they're not fertilized, they're pruned poorly. And so the average age of a street tree in Nevada is about 7 years. So we're hoping that we can maybe improve on that a little bit. The other application is a nursery application, and there's a lot of overlap between these two realms because, you know, in your urban garden, your street trees, you grow it in a nursery first in an organic nursery mix, and then you plant it in mineral soil. And the other application with this project is that Nevada Division of Forestry has their own nursery, and they began applying this biochar into their nursery mix. And this nursery, they're quasi-commercial. They produce native plants only for restoration and for homeowners and DOT projects and things like that. And so we really wanted to do really an initial hazard assessment. As they're applying this biochar, is it going to kill the plants, have no benefit, have a positive benefit? They didn't really know how much to add, so I'm looking at different application rates, as a lot of people were. And the other question we really had is this kiln that we're producing it in, there's really no control. It's a really pretty simple system. There's no control on temperature. You know, it's colder temperature if it's cold outside. The feedstocks are going to change pretty much. So we wanted to see if our production conditions produced a suitable biochar compared to more carefully controlled conditions. Keeps on skipping on me. And this graph is a total mess, but it drives my point home. This is temperature that I measured in our kiln in the bottom, middle, and top. And so temperature and for two different burns. So temperature is variable. Some of the biochar we produce is going to be a low temperature. Some is going to be a high temperature, even in the same kiln, but produced on different days for sure. The feedstock is going to vary as well. So we wanted to compare our kiln to sort of more carefully controlled conditions. So I had separate feedstocks of pinyon and juniper. I had these pyrolyzed at 350, 500, and 700 C by a great lady, Isabel Lima, and USDA ARS did this production for me. I mixed the biochar with the potting media, so this is a peat-based potting media, in ratios of 5, 15, and 30% by mass. So that's pretty large, but in a container, you can apply a lot of biochar in a small area. I did chemical analyses on these pure samples of different temperature and different feedstock biochars, and then I also did a greenhouse study. It keeps on changing on me. And I compared that to our kiln, where the feedstock is going to vary by day, the temperature is unknown. I did chemical analysis on this, also grew plants, and then I did a plant available water study, which I'll finish up with. So orient you to these graphs. We've got what we're interested in on the y-axis. On the x-axis, we have temperature. And then this line is our kiln-produced biochar. And that's the mean and standard deviation. It looks like a blurry line because the standard deviation is small. And we don't know the temperature, so this is just a line. And so if you look at C-to-N ratio, low temperature biochar, higher C-to-N ratio, you're going to have a more greater potential for nitrogen immobilization. As you increase the temperature, you're losing more carbon at the expense of nitrogen. That C-to-N ratio is going down. There's not a lot of spread between pinyon and juniper. Juniper is the black here and pinyon is the white. So the feedstocks are pretty similar. And our kiln biochar has a low C-to-N ratio. So that's one gold star for the kiln biochar. The pH kind of goes up and then levels off. Not a lot of spread between feedstocks. Our biochar has a high pH. So if we're applying a lot of it in an alkaline soil, that could be an issue. Maybe we should add acid and oxidizers to it, as a lot of these talks indicate. But when you apply it to a peat moss, which is acidic, that's not really going to be an issue. Cation exchange capacity was pretty stable with temperature. Not a huge amount of variability with feedstock. You had a little bit lower with the pinyon here. But the cation exchange capacity of our kiln-produced biochar was higher than the other treatments. But to put that in perspective, here's our biochar here on this figure, and yeah, you can see that. You know, it has a higher cation exchange capacity than sandy loams and loamy sands and the tail end of silt loams, but not really compared to clay. So in certain types of soils, it will cause an improvement. And this is raw biochar. It hasn't aged or anything like that. plant nutrients, as you would expect, the plant nutrients that don't volatilize at high temperature increase in concentration. So calcium and magnesium go up with temperature. See a little bit higher calcium in the juniper than you do in the pinyon, but phosphorus volatilizes at high temperature, so you see that leveling off. Our kiln-produced biochar, and once again, the juniper has higher phosphorus. Our kiln-produced biochar has high phosphorus, potassium, but lower calcium than the other systems. But I should emphasize these nutrient values are really pretty low, especially compared to a peat potting mix. So the more biochar you added, these nutrient levels actually went down overall because the peat potting mix has a lot of exchangeable nutrients. And I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. So we don't really think of biochar as a fertilizer. We often think of it as a reactive media. And a colleague of mine, Vimla Nair, did some phosphorus work, and she's going to be talking tomorrow at 9. And so she'll expand on a lot of this, and it should be a very interesting talk. But I should have labeled this. This top graph is juniper, this is pinyon, and this is our kiln-produced biochar. And she did peer retention isotherms, so you add more phosphorus. You look at how that divides into solution and into soil. And what you notice is that the threshold where all of these soils became sources of phosphorus was independent of the production temperature, independent of the feedstock type. This phosphorus release occurs at the same point, and that's the phosphorus saturation threshold of the soil itself. So biochar, so production methodology didn't really play a role in that. You do at these higher temperatures see the 700 degrees C has less release of phosphorus, followed by the 500 and 350, and that trend is pretty consistent. Similarly, if you look at the maximum sorption, where you're adding really high concentrations of phosphorus, you see the 700C has the highest maximum satiation rate, followed by the 350 and the, followed by the 500 and the 350. But as Vimla will mention tomorrow, a lot of this phosphorus is desorbable. So although it's retaining a lot of phosphorus, a lot of that is going to be leached off not provide this benefit. So in conclusion, with the soil chemistry stuff, PJ biochar is not a fertilizer. There's a potential enrichment of phosphorus in biochar. Our kiln biochar has favorable results compared to some of these other treatment systems. So moving forward, it makes sense to use this sort of a system. So I mentioned I did a quick greenhouse study, just sort of an initial hazards assessment. So I grew one of the plants that they're very often growing in this nursery. And I also did a germination study, which I can't talk about today. Once again, at 5, 15, and 30%. And as I mentioned in the abstract, we had neutral to positive growth rates over this short-term greenhouse study. And particularly in the low and high temperature biochars, you see sort of a positive trend as you add more biochar, not as much in the intermediate trend. A lot of variability in these systems, and this is all the different types of biochar pooled together, so maybe that explains some of the variability. Similarly, with leaf count, you see sort of similar trends, neutral to positive growth, but we were happy that we weren't killing these plants in this commercial nursery, and so we decided to really move forward in that direction. All right, so I'm going to finish talking about plant available water. We live in the West in a very drought-ridden area, so if biochar has any influence on plant available water, we're talking about reduced irrigation in nurseries or reduced irrigation of street trees and things like that. So I did a plant available water study, first with a potting mix and second with a mineral soil. And you can see the recipe of the potting mix that they use at their Washoe County or their Nevada Division of Forestry nursery here. And it's a pretty organic mix. And what I also wanted to look at was the effect of particle size. We know particle size influences aggregation and drainage and things like that. So I had a bunch of different particle sizes that I sieved from this larger material, mixed these different particle sizes with the soil, and I really am leaning towards wanting to recommend the coarse biochar, particularly for these nursery applications, just because of the human health issues. I hate working with it, so I don't want to work with it. So I hope the results are terrible with the fine biochar, but we'll see. You pack the soil mixtures consistently, so incorporate it into the soil, like you're tilling it into the soil, saturate, allow it to evaporate over time, measure moisture content and water potential at two different spots with this Decagon High Prop device, which a lot of you are familiar with. And then you model that and you can get plant available water and unsaturated hydraulic conductivity. The plant available water increase in the potting soil was very significant. We saw increases, and this is plant available water increase above the control. We saw increases with all the treatments. The finer material did have higher plant available water, but anywhere from 1 millimeter and above, you didn't really see any sort of effect. So if you're working within that range, you don't have to stress that too much. I also am going to do this on some mineral soils, because even when you're planting street trees, you're planting that in a mineral soil. So I'm going to do a clay, loam, and a sand. I start out with the loam because it's our glorious state soil, and it's very agriculturally important soil in this area. And in this case, I mixed it 5%. The original nursery study was 30%, but I'm going to repeat that with 15 and 5 as well. Once again, plant available water increase above the mineral soil alone for all these treatments. Not as much of an effect of particle size. You see the finest material is kind of low and kind of has an increase, so a lot more variability, but overall positive influence on plant available water. And I want to repeat this with higher amounts of biochar, so I very quickly did an experiment before I came here with 15%, and with an N of 1, there is an indication that more biochar is going to cause a greater effect. And similarly, I did a clay soil because I want to do different soil types, and once again with an N of 1, we actually saw very little to no plant available water increase with a clay soil. So it depends on the soil type, and so I'm going to do this with a bunch of different soil types and try and provide recommendations in that realm. So moving forward, I'm really excited about this. We're going to look at this biochar production method from a systems perspective to see if it really does sequester carbon, look at methane emissions, and measure some human health issues, contaminants, NOx, SOx, particulate matter, and then do a life cycle analysis where we really look at this holistically and look at transportation costs and compare this to doing nothing and letting catastrophic wildfires burn. And so I guess that's the end of my time, but I'd be happy to take any... Let me thank Nevada Division of Forestry and U.S. Forest Service for the funds, and I'd be happy to take questions if we have any time.
One question? No? All right, well, I'd like...
Comment.
Okay.
I'd like you to tell the audience how important...
important this is in terms of the number of acreage we see in the western U.S. that being encroached by pinyon juniper.
Yeah, I mean, it's on, you probably know better than me, but it's on the order of hundreds of millions of acres, or is that too high?
Yeah, it's like 40 million.
Okay. Yeah, so one of the projects, they cleared 5,000 acres, which looked very large to me, but they cleared a lot of PJ, and they were trying to divert some of that to biochar. So there's a big source of feedstock that has no value, really, whatsoever.
All right, thank you. Well, I just want to thank all the speakers in the session. If we can give everyone a hand.